Well, good evening, everybody. I want to welcome you to the April 16th meeting, 2018, of your Ferndale City Council, where you rise with me, and Mr. Sweeney will lead us in the salute of our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
City Clerk will now read the roll call.
Councilmember Zark, here. Councilmember Gregness.
Here.
Councilmember Taylor.
Here.
Councilmember Weiss.
Here.
Councilmember Kennedy.
Here.
And council members Kate Hansen and Keith Olson have requested an excused absence. I look for that motion.
So moved.
Second.
Moved by Councilmember Watson, seconded by Councilmember Hansen to excuse the two council members. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. We now go on to public comment. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to speak to your city council, they're here to listen to you. We'll happily give you 3 minutes and come up, introduce yourself, and tell us where you live, and we're happy to hear you. Paul, that would be you. Thank you for coming.
Excuse me. I'm Paul Engelsberg. Live right on the border of Ferndale, right outside of the city limits. I dropped by some invitations to council members to the Arch of Healing and Reconciliation installation, which is going to happen Saturday morning outside of Bellingham City Hall on the public library grounds. The actual installation is happening this week, weather permitting, but the ceremony is going to be Saturday 21st. It's honoring immigrants to Whatcom County and taking note of three separate incidents that happened over time in which Asian immigrants were expelled from Whatcom County. First, the Chinese in 1885. Second, the immigrants from India in the infamous Bellingham riot of 1907. And lastly, Japanese residents, mostly in Bellingham, who, along with Japanese people of Japanese descent all up and down the coast, were put in internment camps, now known as pretty much incarcerated in concentration camps, in 1942. And in all three of these instances, people never returned to Whatcom County. The event is going to be a joyful one. Although it's grounded in this kind of history that we're not very proud of at all, and we want to sort of turn away from this. The meaning of the arch is to welcome people from all countries. In fact, it's going to have on the tiles beneath the arch welcome in, I think, 15 different languages, including Lummi and Nooksack. And the keynote address is going to be by an immigrant from India himself, Saba Randhawa, who's the president of Western Washington University, and his wife is also going to be speaking at this event. They're both from India. Anyway, I wanted to invite council members, Ferndale staff, audience, everybody. It's open to the public. There's going to be some broadcasts about it. I was just interviewed this morning by KUOW. They came up from Seattle, the local NPR affiliate. The Bellingham Herald, I don't know if you all saw, we had a front page article on Sunday. As a sort of local resident, just want you to know that I've been doing research on this. I'm sort of the historian for the project. I've been doing research on this since the 100th anniversary. That would be 2007. And I just recently retired, so I'm going to be writing a book on it. So if any of you have any ideas, input on the history of prejudice and immigration in Whatcom County, I'd like to hear from you. But I hope you'll all come to the event. It's 10:30 in the morning outside of Bellingham City Hall. We're going to have a bunch of children actually pulling back the veil. So we've invited children. So if you have children of your own or know people with around ages 8 to 13 or so who'd like to be part of that, we'll welcome them. We thought, because the whole idea of this arch is to sort of set a different tone for the next generation of a more accepting, welcoming spirit. So we thought it'd be appropriate for kids to be involved. So thank you.
Thank you, Paul. And before you go,
I have brochures if anyone's interested in some more.
Before you go, I want to thank you publicly for being really the lead historian on this event. And it's fantastic and important. And you have a website, I think it's archofhealing.org.
Yeah.
And there is a wonderful video there that has some of the history, which I saw. So
right, Satpal Sidhu, who's county council member, I'm sure you all know, he and I are on this video. We are interviewed for it. I'll leave a few brochures if people are interested. It has a little bit of the history, a few vignettes.
Thank you, Paul. Would anyone else like to come up and speak to your Ferndale City Council? If you are a student at the high school, you get extra credit for doing this. No takers. We will close the public comment. Council, you now have before you the consent agenda. What is your pleasure?
Move to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Moved by Councilmember Greg Hansen. Seconded by Councilmember Taylor to adopt the consent agenda. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay, and the consent agenda goes into the record. Capital Projects update. Katie Ratter. Welcome. Thank you for spending your Monday night with us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. Good evening, Council. Just give you a quick update on my sheet of stuff. First on my list is the Thornton Road Sewer Project. We pulled the plug, I believe, last Tuesday, so that sewer is now live. Super exciting stuff. Well, we thought it was anyway. We're actually waiting for a window of decent weather, and that looks like it's coming up later this week, so they'll be ready to prep and pave Thornton Street back probably Thursday, Friday this week. So we're hoping to wrap that project up for the most part. Next on my list is the Gateway Storm. Pretty much all that's left to do there is the same as what I updated you on last time, is just the hydro seeding. Washington Street, that's kind of the big project on the horizon. We had a pretty successful... I'd be done. Nice. Washington Street, we had a pretty successful open house. That was on the 4th. We had quite a few residents and interested members of the public attend, so that was good. It was a good way to kind of introduce some of the guys that are going to be working on behalf of the construction firm, RAM, and, you know, the design engineers and the city staff. So that was good. We have planned to close the road starting the 30th of April, and that's a firm date. So work will start, and we're anticipating that will continue through October, and that's a pretty conservative estimate. So we're looking forward to getting that project underway. Next on the list is the Cherry Street sidewalk. We're still working on design. We're hoping to actually wrap in the bid for that project with the Pioneer Pathway project, because they're fairly similar. So we're working on moving those forward and getting that out to bid. Portaway Roundabout, we're still working on getting the approvals needed to get that one out to construction as well. I think we're getting closer. We're on the cusp. So we're talking with WSDOT and getting everything in place so we can get that out to bid.
And the slowdown on that one has been a statement. Slowdown. WSDOT is not bad to see.
No. Yes. Yes. We're and, you know, they're used to working with the big projects. I think they're the local group at WSDOT is very appreciative of the work that the city's trying to do to improve that intersection, and they've been very helpful. So we kind of call it Big WSDOT and Little WSDOT. I think the Big WSDOT guys are maybe not as helpful and lean as they could be, but we're working on them. So. And then next on my list and last is the Thornton Road Overcrossing Project. We're working on furthering design. I know we're very close to having a bridge proposal ready to forward to BNSF, so that's a good thing. We did have a meeting with some of the folks that handle our right-of-way acquisition, the designers, and I think we made some really good decisions on the project to determine what the final footprint is, which will really allow us to get that in place so we can get our permitting underway, work out our right-of-way plan, and start acquiring right-of-way. So we're making good progress on that project as well. So I don't know if anybody has any questions.
I'm curious, with the Thornton Overcrossing, do we have like a percentage yet? Are you 50% done with design, or are you not really at a place where you can say, because I know we're working towards 70.
On the scale of how you measure things, we're farther than 50% on the design, but okay. in the process of getting us to construction, I don't know that we're at that 50% mark.
That's okay. I'm just curious.
We have the road alignment, and you know we know what our footprint's going to be, or we're very close with that, so we can determine you know what kind of right of way we need to get, the permitting, that sort of thing. So you know we know what we're going to do with the utilities, and the bridge designers are pretty well set on how they're going to approach that that portion of it. I know that they were working on realigning and actually eliminating some of the support that aren't needed necessarily, which is a huge cost savings for the city. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
More questions? Ms. Ryder, thank you for coming tonight.
Right. Thank you.
Appreciate that very much. Next on the item, the mayor has invited members of the Community Bond Task Force related to the high school to come and give a presentation. This is an informational presentation. As council knows, should the voters approve this bond, we will be working in partnership with the school district on a rather significant project. So welcome, Wendy and Joe. Great.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Wendy Lawrence, Joe Lupo, formerly members of the Bond Task Force, and why we are here is sort of dubious distinction that you're chair and I'm co-chair of the campaign committee now. So you will be seeing a lot of us in the future. But we do appreciate the opportunity to be here this evening and give you a brief overview of the work we did as a task force and where we got to in terms of a bond proposal that will be on the November ballot. I should probably have Yori brief this, or Greg, since you all guys are alums. Just a quick overview of the district. As you know, we've got 4,700 students that are served by the district. One of the things that became clear to us as we sorted through the material is our schools are old. They need a lot of repairs, and that proved a challenge. But as you know, generally we got a handful of schools, two high schools for now, read the fine print. The school district did announce that Windward will close, so we will really be dealing with one high school in the future, two middle schools, and six elementary schools, as you can see. All right, I'm going to let Joe brief this part.
Okay, so in the beginning, back in about October, the school district hired a third-party facilitator. We got about 40 to 50 people to come and be a part of the initial task force. It went, kind of fluctuated a little bit throughout the thing, but we had 6 months worth of meetings, eight full meetings, two subcommittees. We had a communication subcommittee and a recommendation subcommittee. All in all, I was on both, so I could tell you that all in all, the meetings were about 40 hours, 40 to 45 hours of people's time. So quite a bit of time went into thinking about it, talking about it. We ended up doing two presentations to the board. We ended up doing an initial one that turned out to be essentially very similar to the final one, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. But it was a lot of different people from the community. We had teachers, we had business owners, we had just community members, parents. So we had pretty diverse group. We had a lot of kids come and speak and be involved. We did a few forums where we did small group work. We did forums where we did had a panel come and talk, and we got to ask them questions. It was very intense at times because we pushed the district for a lot of good information. So we feel like we kind of created a good process throughout. So as we went through, we identified a lot of different needs at, like she said, all the different schools, 6 elementary schools, 2 middle schools, and essentially 2 high schools at the time. But we got to walk through each one. We got to see, you know, what the maintenance people are dealing with. We got to talk about the priorities and actually get into the weeds of what are the true priorities. We had the school board set a kind of a criteria for us, to where our initial criteria was the high school had to be a signature project and we couldn't go over $100 million. We soon learned that the high school was definitely going to be a signature project, but we were not going to be able to do what we wanted to do for $100 million. So we requested the school board drop the cap, essentially, and allow us to not be confined by that constraint and allow us to actually do our work and see what happens as we come out of it.
And that, I think, was important because we didn't want to be constrained from the get-go. Because the more we took on bullet number one, identifying the needs, it became very clear to us that there were many, many needs. And they're throughout the district, at virtually every school. Something needs to get done. And to best position the district for the years ahead, we had to address more than just the high school. This slide sums it all up, but I think we want to spend just a few minutes telling you where we started at. So the district did some of their homework first and gave us some options that we could start with concerning the high school. There was one option where it would be a completely new high school in a brand new location. That was, what, $120 million? That one didn't go over well. That was a sticker shock price tag for most of us in the room. The other thought was keep the current location, build all new, and that was a $115 million proposal. And then there was a third option with the starting proposition of we'll just renovate the Performing Arts Center, the cafeteria, and the gymnasium. The rest will be new. And that's where we converged, but there was a lot of back and forth because, again, we had some really great members of the task force, like Joe with his construction background, where we didn't necessarily want to be constrained. We pushed back on that idea a little bit. We really probed and we prodded and explored that. What does it mean to renovate a building? How much life will you get out of it? About 20 years. Hey, what happens if you build new? That's about 50 years. So we immediately saw that we were going to be in this cycle where we had a handful of renovated buildings where we would be coming back in 20 years to ask the voters again to renovate those buildings. Meanwhile, we had more than half of the school that was at a 50-year life. And we had significant concerns about what happens when you renovate and, as I like to use the HGTV example, you go in and you start renovating something and you find the big reveal, the big aha, and it's bad news and it blows up your budget. Who's on tap for that? Was it the contractor? Was it the school district? That wasn't necessarily a straightforward answer. We didn't want to put the school district in a position where bad news was discovered because these are very old buildings and now you're on tap for a significant cost overrun. So we had one member of the task force who came up with what we thought was the best compromise, which was, you have a cafeteria, it's rated okay in your survey, but it doesn't hold all your students. It's too small to meet your needs. So let's build that new. Let's build the gym new, but let's renovate the Performing Arts Center because it's still in very good shape. It's recognized as one of the top 20 performing arts center in the state. So let's just focus on a little bit of modernization. So as you can see here, we settled on about, what, 20,000 square feet of a new high school building? Well, 250 when we get the Performing Arts Center. So the new portion is a little over 220 square feet. So that will be $105 million. We'll renovate the Performing Arts Center for $2 million. And then where we really pushed back on the district was when you're given, it was really hard from a bond task force member perspective to be given a list of projects at every school and to see that every school needed something and there was no way that we were going to be able to raise the money to do that. So was there another way to tackle this critical maintenance piece? And again, when you get people with Joe's background, my background being in the military, it helped us think about things a little bit differently. And we went back to the district and we really pushed on them and said, you guys need to prioritize this list for us because we don't have the background. We are not in the schools on a daily basis. Yes, we have people with some construction experience, with some maintenance experience, but you need to go do your due diligence and tell us what your most critical needs are. And to their credit, by the next meeting we had that list. And it's about $4 million to meet what were termed the level one critical maintenance needs. Safety and security, everybody agreed with. That's $1 million, roughly, to be spent at all the district facilities. And I'm going to let Joe talk about the last recommendation because he's the brainchild behind this.
So what happened as we got into this, about 2 months into this, we saw some of the feedback we were getting was, so some of it was negative. Some of it was, we don't feel like we were led astray, or we don't feel like we were told everything, and whether they were or weren't, it didn't really matter. That was the perception. So as you all know in your positions, that's what happens. Perception rules. So what we did is we kind of talked, working with Linda and Mark and Wendy, we kind of came up with, well, what can we do to kind of take over that perception piece from the district and really let the task force or the community that stays involved own it. So we came up with a community oversight committee. It's no different than a lot of committees that are throughout different municipalities. As a matter of fact, Anacortes used this. Highline School District used this. So it's not uncommon. A lot of districts around the country use it. But essentially what this does is this has volunteers throughout the community, whether it's, you know, for example, some of you or just business owners or us or, you know, just people that are willing to volunteer their time with a little bit of experience, a little bit of background, that they can then play a role and they can ask the questions and then relay that information to the community timely. Because really that's what the breakdown is it kind of got backburnered and to no fault of the districts, I don't want to place blame because it wasn't anybody's fault. It just wasn't communicated well. So people felt like they were taken advantage of. And so what we want to make sure is that we communicate this timely and it all engulfing, right? So we want to make sure that, you know, why did they have an overrun or an underrun? And why are they making decisions one way or another? This kind of takes that off the district, puts it on a group of community members that then can, you know, essentially own it a little bit. And I think that once we rolled that out, that got a lot of people kind of doing the, okay, this sounds like something that we can get behind, because they felt like it wasn't just the district now kind of controlling the ball. They had a little bit of people that they probably will know, probably maybe do business with, maybe that's them, maybe it's their family, but somebody else besides the district that they can go to and say, hey, what's going on here? Or why is something turning out the way it is? So that got a lot of positive movement, which really, for me, that was kind of a turning point, I think.
Yeah, I think we've gotten good feedback. We're still in the process of coming up with guidelines for application. There'll be much more information about community involvement in the oversight committee in the coming weeks. But as you can see, our final bond proposal, $112 million, much lower than the last time when it was $125 million. So I'll let Joe talk to this piece as well.
So negotiated, because we all kind of had a role in this, but we're talking two-story building, utilized one roof. That's always the best, especially in our area. We're talking classrooms and a gym constructed, what I call the practice field, what is the field to the north of the existing gym. And so it minimizes the impact. So what we're going to be able to do is keep kids in the classroom during construction. Now, there will be, I can't quite wrap my head around how we're going to not have a gym, but there's going to be a little bit of downtime where the kids may be playing one season away. but so be it. The we can make sure and write good quality specifications to deal with that. Drainage issues at the site. As we all know, the track and the existing field space are very poorly drained. That'll get taken care of. We'll have a new stadium, a new track, and the stadium will be artificial turf and lit to the level that we will be able to have home games after the regular season. So not a lot of people know this, but the reason we have to go to a Civic Field or an out-of-town game after regular season games is because our field doesn't meet the criteria that's set in the Northwest League Conference to be a postseason game. So we don't have the lighting requirements, we don't have the field requirements. So that will be taken care of. We'll have a play field in a portion of the area where the existing school is. And the goal, additionally, is to incorporate some of the old Main. A lot of people that, whether they wrote in or voiced their opinion, was that old Main had an experience for them that they wanted to try and keep that element. So we're going to try and find a way to keep a piece of that facade in some element at the new campus. So it will be enclosed as well. I mean, this doesn't go into a lot of detail, which is fine, but, we'll have way more of an enclosed campus. We'll have, some outside area that the kids will be able to congregate in that won't be, out in a parking lot and things like that.
So as you can see from Performing Arts Center, we got Steve Menefee to help out with this, and that was very helpful to have him come to one of the Bond Task Force meetings and just talk about, if he were in charge, where would he focus his efforts in renovation for the Performing Arts Center. And so there are some groundwater repairs that need to be done, basically modernizing the sound and lighting systems that are already installed, new HVAC, some repairs to the roof, try and upgrade the sprinkler system as well, and a handful of other technology upgrades. But for the most part, that building will be remain as it is, but we'll bring it up to much more modern standards. I sat and watched your son Taylor and Filler on the roof and thought these kids are tremendous, and it would be really, really nice to give them the quality systems to show just how great they really are. Safety and security, as we said, every facility in the district needs something to address the safety and security concerns. There are way too many access doors. There are, 80, 90-some doors at the high school. There's just no way to do an efficient lockdown. So this is a real challenge for the district. So this will be addressed as well. And we really felt strongly that the exterior lighting needed to be considered as part of the safety and security upgrade, because there are parts of the parking lot that are too dark for the students, and that becomes a concern, as you can see. You want to do maintenance?
Yeah, so $4 million. What does $4 million get you? $4 million is what we looked at as the level one critical need. So these are things that affect rot in the building or water getting into the space where the kids are, the cold or heat differential that they've been dealing with, the lack of ability to control the HVAC system, hot water tanks that are 15 plus years old that are just going to be a maintenance nightmare at any given time. One could have gone out right now for all we know. I mean, it's stuff that is what the maintenance department has spent countless hours chasing and really trying to play catch up on. And by doing these $4 million worth of work will really give the maintenance that breather to be able to do the real items that are considered maintenance, not the items that are considered an actual replacement because of its age, which, in theory, could or should have been done before now.
And again, to the district's credit, we actually have a list of specific projects at a handful of schools. So when we say leaks, we know which roofs need to be repaired. So the district really helped us out, and we were able to get down into the weeds here. And so there are very specific project details that are part of this bond proposal. So I think we've touched on a lot of this
the safety concerns, the access doors, trying to control access to the buildings if you have an emergency situation. We've gotten great input from the community. We will work with the architect to ensure that the new high school incorporates everything that's already at Ferndale High School right now, particularly with the CTE, athletics and music programs as well. So I'll let you just look through that. And again, I think really the reason why we pushed so hard on maintenance, as Joe said, is you know, you have a boiler at the high school that was surplused off a Navy destroyer, and I am going to figure out which destroyer it was, but steam boilers went out of the Navy in the 1980s, and so there's no way to find parts to maintain this boiler, okay, that it's obsolete. And so you have an inordinate amount of time and money that is going into a maintenance pit like that. And if we can modernize and build new, frees up the money, as Joe said, that can be used on the next level of maintenance needs in the district. So, how much will it cost? Because everybody wants to know.
Wendy, can you step?
Yeah. How much will it cost? This is an eye chart. It shows you where the enrichment, you know, how what's being spent on our enrichment levies, which we used to call the M&O levies. They're now called enrichment levy post-McCleary. The McCleary piece, the state school part, the existing bond from the 2006 bond that was passed, which will expire in 2022, and what the new bond would add. This does not tell you the impact to your pocketbook. This is a slide that tells you that. It's a little bit of an eye chart. I apologize. But the good news is the summary here. This year you all saw a big tax increase due to McCleary. That was a one-time hit. That tax rate is going down next year, and if the legislature is true to its promise, it stays down. The enrichment levy goes down to 1.5. The school portion goes down and will stay at 3.2. What it means to your pocketbook is even if we pass this bond, next year is a little bit of an outlier. It will still be $45 below what you paid in 2017 for the school-related portion of your property tax. Then it goes up to just $45 more probably for the next many years. So for just $45 more a month, you'll get a new high school, and you'll get your critical maintenance needs. So I think thanks to the work done by
a year, right?
A year. $45 a year will be your tax increase. So thanks to the legislature with the McCleary fix, I think for us this ends up being a good tax story.
She meant when, by the way, not if it passes.
When it passes, yes, I'll be optimistic. So if you want more information, it's on the district site. There is a community bond task force website as well with the final report is there. I don't know if you all have any particular interest in having a copy of the report. If so, I can give it to Susan. I have it on Thumb Drive. You can email it to people. It's a little long, but it's got a lot of great information. So, any questions for us?
City Council, we appreciate you being here, and when that passes, you have the full resources of the city to get you through it. Joe, thank you for helping out. Wendy, you as well. Come back again.
Thank you.
Progress there. Very good. Appreciate that a lot. Going on to the next item, which will be a lifesaver for the City Council and the Mayor, is a presentation on what's called the appeal process. You don't have to be a council member more than 3 weeks before you will meet a citizen that wants you to help with their possible disagreement with the city and what to do. You're going to learn what to do today. This is a great presentation.
All right.
Mr. Burnett, welcome.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor. Good evening, City Council. My grandparents told me that there was a movie called that was based on this title, so I decided to steal it. But it is actually true. We're speaking from my own personal experience. When I first started working for the city, the concept of an appeal was scary. I mean, it was nuclear war. We can't get to an agreement with an applicant, and so we need to have mommy or daddy resolve it, and it seemed to be a failing on our part where we couldn't reach a conclusion. And it was really kind of coming out of some of the misconceptions, and I think that applicants feel this way as well, is you can't fight City Hall. There's no way that you can win in a debate with City Hall, so don't even try. It was a time waster. Or that an appeal was going to be just a battle. And I guess pick who you are in the picture there, whether we're the referee or a boxer or the hearing examiner or the appellant is one of those. Just a mess is a lot of those misconceptions. But in reality, the appeal process is one of the clearest illustrations of our local separation of power. And I think I'll get back to it in a little bit, but I will talk about it a little bit more right now in case I forget to get back to it. You are our legislative branch. You are responsible for adopting new rules and regulations, but you're not in charge of enforcing them. That's the executive's branch, and really Ferndale staff are within the executive division, where that's where we take the laws that are adopted and we apply them. Hopefully we'll come back to you when we see that things are not working right and let you know. But often, not often, sometimes, the judicial branch is going to be called in to make those determinations as far as whether or not we're applying things correctly, such as in the appeal process, or, and this is what our city attorney is for, to determine whether the rules that you are considering are, in fact, constitutional. Ideally, again, if we find that we're not applying them correctly or that the rules themselves are poor, they will come back to you and we'll say, hey, here's what we need to work on. So that's where the separation of powers is less so a separation and more we all rely on one another to make sure that the regulations work. But for appeals, we talk about lean every Friday. How can we make our lives easier, more efficient? And it really is one of the more effective, leanest regulations that the city has, where because we use it hundreds of times each year, probably literally someone at City Hall uses the appeal process each day, which is weird because we actually average less than one appeal per year. So how does that work? I'm going to get into that. First, though, we have our code language, and it's a clear, bright line for us. If we apply our code language, then we will be doing our job correctly. But you see the end of the arrow there and how it's wider than the main path. That's because there's room for interpretation or discretion. It's that gray area. But we're following in the general purpose statement or philosophy of our codes. That's the wider area of the whatever shape that is, the arrow, where there is some room for interpretation. And that's really, you might say that there's room for innovation, too, is within that general purpose statement, that's where people can come up with new ideas that still respond to our overall goal, but are somewhat different from what we'd considered. We want to have our code language have a fairly broad arrow so that we can allow for some interpretation and some movement. We don't want to be overly prescriptive. We don't want it just to be a bar, which the code language is all that it is. That's why the arrow is so important.
Here, can you pull out of your hat like an illustration of that in real life, real time?
Sure. We're so I'm going to use maybe more of our facilities or utilities as an example. It might not be as specific, but we might say that you need to convey water, sewer, whatever, I'll do it for stormwater because that's really where there is a lot of innovation. The goals are fairly clear. You need to treat and detain stormwater on your site before releasing it off-site. And the conventional way of doing that, the really conventional way of doing it was not treating it, but instead just sticking it into a ditch. But once you do start talking about treating it, the conventional way was with a stormwater pond. But there have been a lot of innovations where folks have said, gosh, you know, that's taking up a whole bunch of land area on my site. I can do it a lot more simply by using things from, there's a hydro swirl thing. There's also a thirsty duck that's been put in where they can measure release or measure or reduce the footprint of that storm infrastructure while still meeting the technical requirements of not releasing it more than it needs to be. So that's where some innovation can come in, where folks said, gosh, these requirements are costing too much in terms of time, money, and land. There must be a better way to do it. And a city was able to say, you know what? Yeah, that meets the intent of the code. But we also know, and I'm not going to explain what BS stands for. I think you're probably familiar. There's our BS and there's their BS, where this is outside of the arrow. Sometimes their BS is we just don't want to do it. That it's going to cost too much and we're not going to propose something else, or a city that doesn't actually exist, Never Never Land, allows them to use this in this facility, so should Ferndale. You say, well, tell us more about Never Never Land. Well, they're great. You can't find them on a map, but they're great. Well, you know, that's probably some of their BS. Our BS is sometimes we're the city, and you will do what we say, and we're not going to listen to your argument. Even if it's not in code, we're going to make you do this because we're sick and tired of negotiating with you. Either way, we know that this area is defendable. The bright line, as well as the room for interpretation, the gray area, and the other parts are not. So that's why we have this code section, Chapter 1411070, which says that any party that feels aggrieved by an administrative decision may submit an appeal. They need to do that within 10 calendar days of the interpretation or decision, and in our code violation language, it has similar stuff. So if you disagree with us, you have 10 days to appeal. What that chapter code section does is it clearly establishes our position as well as the basis for that position. So we can't just simply say, no, I'm done talking. This is my final decision. You have 10 days to appeal. What we typically do is we say, based on this code section and our interpretation of that code section, our answer is this. And you have 10 days to appeal that, where now they get that clear understanding of what our thought process is. By ending the debate relatively early, it prevents it from getting personal. Because sometimes in all interactions, if you keep on, what's the definition of
insanity?
Of insanity is doing the same, thank you, doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result, where if the applicant keeps on using the same justification for something, and we keep on saying no, boom, 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 eventually you're going to get tired and you're going to start saying, well, actually, it's because you're stupid. And then it gets personal, and then it becomes much more difficult to resolve the other issues. It also prevents it from getting political. You're the legislative branch. You should not be involved in these individual project decisions.
Say that again.
You are the legislative branch. That's why we try to come back to you with code changes and things like that and to explain to you what's going on. But applicants should not feel that a course of action is to appeal up to the council or really for that matter to the mayor, where this is something where our code gives the various department heads the responsibilities to make these decisions. It also forces the applicant to make a strategic decision quickly within those 10 days. How good is their argument? Where they might think, okay, if I can only get past Yuri or Kevin and I can talk to one of my neighbors or the mayor who I've known forever or someone else that might not understand as much, then I can use my salesman argument. But if they know that they're going in front of the hearing examiner, who doesn't care who they know or how cute they sound or how funny they might be, if he just looks at the legal argument, how good is that argument actually? We also, from the city's perspective, have to recognize that this is a tool ourselves, where if we lose an appeal, it simply tells us if our code is strong or not. It allows for the hearing examiner, an impartial third party, to look at those facts and as objectively as possible, separate from a motion. And really, the worst thing that can happen to us, because typically the life safety is in that white area, right? We're strong on life safety. The worst thing is that we need to now change our code. That's not such a bad thing to go through. It's a tool to understand that within our fishbowl, maybe we're not as strong as we thought. And it's not a weapon. Where there is sincere versus malicious misinterpretation, where sometimes staff might think that a code says one thing, and it turns out that it doesn't. It's quite another when we know that a code doesn't say this, but we're still using that as a battle axe against them. We need to determine if our determination is valid. Are we in the clear? Is it in that white area? Is it gray where, okay, there's different interpretations? Or is this BS where we know that the hearing examiner is going to call us out as well? And is it really our final decision? And that's an important thing to remember because I learned the hard way on an application where I told the Rojas in this case that their permit had expired. And then a couple weeks later, I indicated to them that I was willing to negotiate on that, where I gave them mixed messages. And because of that, they were able to appeal, and they were actually able to win the appeal. The only one I think we've lost is because I did not state something was a final decision, but I acted as if it was, and then I reversed myself. So, recommendations to staff primarily. Provide or ask a director to provide a final decision as early in the process as appropriate. And here it's important to remember that there might be some things where we've reached our decision on this, but we're still wanting to negotiate or discuss this. The final decision should only be on this part, not we've made our final decision on your whole application. That's when lengthy debates, when there's no progress being made, and when we do our technical review committee responses, where we can tell them fairly early on, we've come to these conclusions, here you go, work off of this, but this is our final decision. We should also include appeal language on permits, that's our final decision as well. Always cite to the code section that we're basing our decision on, and remember, if we can't cite to a code section, we should really question whether or not we are making a good decision. And for example, here's the language that we could use for that. So that is the presentation.
Council, questions, discussion?
No, it was excellent. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
I was a council member for 6 years, and there's this huge internal temptation to want to adjudicate, judge, decide, fix, and you've got to say no. And this is your best tool. Did you tell how much it costs to do this?
So courts have found that cities that have very high appeal costs are actually barring people from appealing, barring them from going into that first right that they have, same as, you know, requiring costs for voting and things like that. So the city requires a $700 fee. There is no separate hearing examiner fee. The city will always pick up the hearing examiner costs for an appeal. If the appellant wins, $700, their full fund is spent back to them. If they lose, we take the $700. Typically, the time, if it's a really black and white thing and there aren't attorneys involved, we can get them on the next month's agenda. Certainly, if there are attorneys, they have to go through briefing schedules, and that can push it out. But so it really is something where sometimes when you see the debates going back and forth for 2 or 3 months at a time, the appeal process might be the better way to go, because then you can focus on other things and you can get going.
Very good. It's very reasonable. And some of you have seen Michael Bobby in action. It's worth watching. Nobody is more cold, motionless, not swayed by tears or anything else. Just what does the code say? Mm-hmm. Strictly down the line. Council member.
So is it $700 per item? Or like if you were appealing 3 or 4 things. Like if you said you can't do this, you can't do that, and you can't do this either, could you just pay $700 and have all three of them adjudicated at the same time? Or
Yes, we haven't had that particular circumstance, but typically we have had multiple variance requests as part of one application, and it is just that one fee.
Okay.
For it.
Very good. That was well done. We should run that every year, so that's a good view. Going on the agenda, the last item is an ordinance prohibiting parking in front of mailbox. Special guest today. Glad to have you.
Good evening. So parking in front of a mailbox in Ferndale is not prohibited. There is no state law or federal law that prohibits parking in front of a mailbox. The problem is that the post office will not deliver mail to a blocked mailbox, and that can be a problem, especially when mailboxes, as they often are now, are put together in banks. So parking in front of one mailbox bank could affect a whole neighborhood getting their mail. The postmaster has indicated to us that approximately 50 to 60 mailboxes are blocked every month, so it happens quite a bit. We brought some language to council committee last week, and there was some discussion about time-limited parking, holidays, 24 hours, and it was decided that the best route to go would be parking outright 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, unless picking up or dropping off mail. So staff made those changes. That's what you see in your staff report, Exhibit 1.
Do you want to scroll down a little so we can see that, Kevin?
That's it in the red. Pretty simple. No parking within 10 feet of a mailbox, except for dropping off or picking up mail. That's the gist of it. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Pretty simple backstory. It was a citizen that contacted the city, contacted the mayor's office about a couple small items. This was one of them. And I was in the post office, and I wanted to find out what the rules were. I met the postmaster. She said, we require 10 feet on each side, but there's no law. So that's it. One citizen. I don't know if they're here today. They were going to come.
Nope. That's nice.
Kind of fun. Council, questions? This is not a public hearing. Customer Watson.
So are you going to want us, because we've talked about the Pacific Highlands HOA, do you want us to do something with the curb? Because I don't think we're going to put up signs everywhere. Do you want us to paint the curb? Is there some color that?
I don't think that was part of the scope of the discussion at committee, so I think we'd have to have a different discussion about that.
Okay.
We will be doing a public information campaign to remind people and perhaps staging a photo using Kevin's car. It's a BMX.
Direction from council.
Go ahead.
Councilmember Watson, please.
I'll move to approve Agenda Bill 1804-007.
Second.
Moved by Councilmember Watson and seconded by Councilmember Gray Hansen to adopt the ordinance to prohibit parking 24/7 within 10 feet of any mailbox in the city of Ferndale. Discussion. Seeing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. And the ordinance has passed. And thank you for the quick work on that. That was about a two-week turnaround on that one.
Great, thank you.
That's the way it should be done. Moving on to mayor reports. I don't have anything except to mention that there was a terrific cherry blossom festival on Saturday. It was extremely well attended and appreciated by citizens throughout the county. And this Saturday is the annual spring cleanup day in downtown city. Your dad doing the hot dogs again?
Yeah,
of course he is. Yeah. So I think it starts at 9, I'm going to guess.
Yes.
And clean up the city. Glad to have you. And that's all the mayor has. Council reports. See you now. Staff reports. Mr. Barnett?
Nothing.
Public Works?
I'm good.
Finance?
Nothing.
City Clerk?
Registration is open for the AWC annual conference. And
the great city?
In Yakima, yes. And we did put some money in the budget for council member training, so some of you could go to that.
What is the cost?
It's $400.
That's not included in a hotel, though, does it?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very good.
And if you are interested and want to ask me, I can register for you or register for yourself.
It's June and Yakima.
Do you have a link on the training?
Yes, I can email it.
It's awcnet.com,
I think. It is.
.org.
.org.
Thank you very much. Our communications officer.
Just want to mention the skate park community meeting was last Thursday. Thank you, council members, Hanson, Dar, and Watson, who attended. It was we got about 30 members of the public there and got some great feedback about the potential skate park. Just put together the application, and we'll keep you updated. The Ferndale Arts Commission is hosting a swing dance, not this Saturday, but next Saturday at the Pioneer Pavilion from 7 to 9 p.m. It's free, and it's foot-tapping fun. And then, of course, we've got glow-in-the-dark croquet the Saturday after that, May 5th, starting at 8 p.m. It'll be at Griffintown Park, and should be colorful.
And there is an opening on the 9-member Arts Commission. So
Arts.
Arts. Yeah, I said arts.
That's also the Ferndale Garage Sale Day.
Yes.
Very good.
Citywide Garage Sale.
Chief of Police. Very good. I would love to hear a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.